The human being is of such a design that it perceives everything by contrast. There is no way of knowing whether the real world is arranged the same way or not. But we are a nervous system composed of neurons in an extraordinarily complicated pattern based on a very simple principle called is you is or is you ain't. The neuron in transmitting any sensory input either fires or doesn't. So you could represent the fact that it fires by the figure 1 and that it doesn't by the figure 0. And out of 0 and 1, with those two integers alone, you can represent all conceivable numbers. This is called binary arithmetic, and it is the kind of arithmetic that is used by digital computers. Messages in 0-1 language can convey not only mathematical and verbal information, but also information that comes out as television, both black and white and in color. And through the same notation, we can convey solid objects. You can turn a solid object into terms of this notation at one end of a process and have it come out at the other end of the process, engraved in plastic, enlarged or diminished at will by the operation of laser beams. So one is tempted, therefore, to think that is you is or is you ain't is fundamental to the universe. The Chinese thought so, and therefore devised the yang and the yin, yang meaning positive and yin meaning negative, principles, upon which they based the Book of Changes, the I Ching, showing the various combinations of yang and yin that constitute the 64 basic situations of life. They took hexagrams. Hexagrams made up of 6 lines. An unbroken line representing the yang and a broken line representing the yin. So if you have 6 lines with the two possibilities for each line, you get 64 different hexagrams. They used this for making decisions. When it was necessary to make a decision, you would, by a random process, arrive at one of the 64 hexagrams, and on the basis of that, decide what you were going to do. It's rather like tossing a coin, only this coin has 64 sides instead of 2. But it all comes down to, is it heads or tails? Is it yang or is it yin? Now this seems absolutely basic to our life. And it's rather awkward. Because when we apply this to the pursuit of pleasure, it seems to be saying, yes, you can have pleasure, but you will not know what it is unless you can contrast it with non-pleasure. And if you want to know pleasure, then you must have non-pleasure. If you want one end of the spectrum, you've got to know the other, because you can't have a one-ended spectrum any more than you can have a magnet with one pole. And that seems to put an awful kibosh on everything we're trying to do. Every sort of achievement, every sort of progress, every sort of rearrangement of things always runs into the problem that what you gain on the roundabout, you lose on the swings. And this is dispiriting, to say the least. But in a way, oh, how true. So let's look into this business rather thoroughly. Because if you understand the yang and the yin, you really understand something. The first point is this. Let me sort of clarify the situation in its most simple terms. We'll take the contrast of black and white. Now, obviously, if I am confronted with a black background, there's nothing particular to register upon my attention, and I'm as good as blind. If I'm confronted with a purely white background, there is nothing in particular to attract my attention, and I am as good as blind. If, however, I'm a naughty little boy, and I'm confronted with a black wall, and I have a piece of chalk, I am tempted to make a mark on it. And if I'm confronted with a nice, clean, white wall, and I have a piece of charcoal in my hand, I'm tempted to make a black mark, because nature abhors a vacuum. So here I have a black ground with a white dot on it, and a white ground with a black dot. Interesting. Now, of black and white, which is positive and which is negative? If I look at the white background with the black dot, I shall be inclined to say that the black is positive, because it's the thing, it's the mark. If I look at the black background with the white dot, I shall, on the other hand, be inclined to say that the white is the positive, because it's the thing, it's the mark. I can think of white as positive in general, in that it's light, and black as negative because it's darkness. But I can also think of white as negative because it's blank. French, blanche. I can think of black as positive because it's not blank, it's all filled up. Then again, I can think of the dot as being the negation in both cases, because my black background with a white dot is a picture of a wall with a hole in it, and my white background with a black dot is a picture of a box with a hole in it. But I can choose it either way I like, call white negative and black positive, or vice versa. But it's difficult to do both at the same time. Now, they are, of course, these two, as different can be. We say it's as different as black and white. Or we also say these two points of view are the poles apart. And we use the word polarization rather incorrectly to indicate an increase of discord in society. Whereas polarization is really a form of harmony. The two poles of the earth are the harmony of the earth. The two poles of the magnet are the harmony of the magnet. Because they're like male and female. A man and a woman are not the poles apart in the sense that they have no common ground. We could say, you can't have a fight between a shark and a tiger because they have no common ground. One lives on land and the other in the water. But there is common ground between poles, obviously. The common earth is the common ground between the north and the south, and the common magnet, if it's electrical. The circuit runs from the positive to the negative. And the circuit won't begin to run until a negative pole is established. That's what happens when you turn on the switch. So therefore, although the black and the white, the positive and the negative, are as different can be, they're also the same, because they're differences of one field. And this is what makes the difference between what we'll call an exoteric point of view and an esoteric point of view in philosophy, religion, and so forth. From the exoteric point of view, The black and the white are emphasized with respect to their difference. Good and bad, life and death. Oh, how different. Light and darkness. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. That's the exoteric point of view. But always behind that, there's a secret. Every religion has a secret. There's always something esoteric. What is the esoteric thing that is only revealed to initiates, to people who can stand it? It's simply that black and white, although explicitly different, are implicitly one. Because you can't have one without the other. You could say black is white, if by the word is, you mean implies. The Buddhists say, emptiness is form, and form is emptiness. The Chinese way of saying it is not quite the English way. It isn't equals. It rather means, Chinese is saying, void that form. Form that void. In other words, it implies. It goes with, if I may invent a word. So we say that is esoteric. You mustn't let it out in church that God has a dark side as well as a light side. But it says so. Isaiah 45:7. I am the Lord and there is none else. I form the light and create the darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Well, there's your answer to the problem of evil. So, but that, you see, we don't let out, because someone who wants to commit a murder, they say, there's no reason I shouldn't commit a murder, because if somebody didn't commit murders, you wouldn't know what nice people were. If somebody didn't steal or cheat, you wouldn't recognize honest men. Like if it wasn't a wet day occasionally, you wouldn't enjoy the sunshine. There's no getting around it that that's true. St. Paul wrestled with this problem when he saw that the law of Moses made people conscious of right and wrong. I had not known that there was lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. So therefore, he said, asking rhetorically, shall we sin that grace may abound? Oh, misiginito, heaven forbid. So you have to be careful that you don't let this get into the hands of children. Like it says on the bottle of poison, keep away from children. And yet we have poison and we have uses for poison. So in the same way, we have uses for evil. In the ordinary way, we do a balancing act between them. And what we do is this. We establish an in-group and say, this in-group, which is us, has a collective ego. And it is wrong to do anything evil to any member of this group. But it's all right to do it to somebody who's not in the group. Therefore, when we are going to be very evil to someone, we have to define that person as outside the group. And so, we, like when Hitler was going to persecute the Jews, they were defined as not really human. And likewise, if we're going to persecute the Negroes, we define them as not really human. People can easily see, they can imagine that because a Negro looks so different from a Caucasian, that he's more like an animal. Or you can take people who are generally thought to be insane, and you can deprive them of civil rights without due process. They're insane. They're defined as not all there. They're not human, merely bodies. Their mind is absent. We used to do that with heretics and other very seriously diseased people, lepers and so on. They were outcasts. They were not humans, and they were therefore outlawed. They didn't have the protection of the in-group. So the worst thing we can do in eating is cannibalism. Don't eat your own kind. You may eat everything else, but not your kind. But that still doesn't get away from the fact, you see, that you cannot eat, you cannot live without eating, and you cannot therefore live without death, without committing murder. I don't know what the practical solution to that is, except one I've suggested is that if you do eat any living creature, at least you can show your respect by cooking it well. As Lin Yutang said, a fish that has died for you and has not been well cooked has died in vain. Now, there are very, very interesting applications of this theorem. Let's look at some of the contrasts in terms of which we are aware. Primary, of course, is what is myself and what is not, which is a sort of contrast not of two ends of a pole, but rather of the center of a circle and the circumference of the circle. Of course, those are two ends of the radius, one end still, the other end moving. And we say, we feel, there is a great difference between myself and other. I do not know your thoughts, I do not feel your pleasures and pains unless I'm in a sympathetic relationship with you. I don't know what you're going to do. My actions are voluntary, yours are involuntary so far as I am concerned. And yet when I think it over, I realize that I could not realize self without the contrast of other. I wouldn't know what I meant by myself unless I meant something contrasting by someone else or something else. Self means self only because other means other. Just in the same way as is means is only because you can think of isn't. And you know isn't what isn't means because you know what is means, and you know what is means because you know what isn't means. There's a relation. And so, likewise, with the black and the white, we see the relation. But that implies that self and other are inseparable. They go with each other. Characteristic of the difference between self and other is voluntary behavior and involuntary behavior, what you do on the one hand and what happens to you on the other. This is not always quite coterminous with the difference between self and other, because when you have hiccups, you feel that it happened to you, but it was your hiccups, or belly rumbles, or headache, or whatever. What about when you breathe? Do you do it or does it happen to you? That's a very moot case, because you can feel you're doing it, but you can also feel it happening to you. So perhaps the distinction between the voluntary and the involuntary is a little arbitrary, a little vague. Certainly it is when it comes to breathing. But once again, I think, how could I say of an act, I've done it, unless there were contrasting acts of which I could say I didn't do them. So I need the involuntary if I am to have any voluntary. So that if there is a union of implication between the two, I get the same sort of relationship between them as I explained when I said you can use white for either the positive or the negative symbol. In other words, I can regard what I do as what happens to me, and I can regard what happens to me as what I do. It is in this sense that a Hindu or a Buddhist will say, if you have an accident, it was your karma. Because the word karma means nothing more than doing. You had an accident. It was your doing. Well, we would say that's not fair. And naive people suppose it was their doing in the sense that this mishap is a punishment for a misdeed you did at a former time. That's only a superstitious meaning of karma. Karma means literally you did it. But you did your accident in the same way, you see, as you do certain other things that are classified as involuntary, like growing your hair or digesting your dinner. Because it all depends what you mean by you. If you restrict self to the voluntary, then you get the distinction between what you did and what you didn't do. But if the self really must include the other and the involuntary, then others are your others, and involuntary happenings are your deeds. That's rather interesting. You may feel, as a result of seeing that, one of two things. You may feel that you really don't do anything at all, that you are in a completely deterministic universe where everything happens, that your own voluntary decisions and deeds spring out of unconscious mental mechanisms which determine them completely, so that you are at best only a witness of what happens. Or you can feel the opposite of that. You can feel that you are God, and that you are doing everything. That rocks fall, water is wet, and fire hot, because of you. Which is in a way true, because the sun would not be light except in relationship to eyes that can see light. Nor would rocks be hard except in relation to relatively soft skin. Nor would they be heavy except in relation to a certain musculature. So by the way you are, you evoke the way the world is. We might say there are some vibrations out there that are really out there. But these vibrations are not colored or soft or hard or light or dark or light or heavy until in relation to some sensitive system. But then again, the sensitive nervous system is part of the external world. And the external world is an event in the nervous system. The inside of the box is outside the box, and the inside and the outside is inside. I mean, you know, it seems to flip-flop perpetually. Take again another contrast, the solid and the space. Most of us think that reality is solid rather than space. We talk about hard facts. We talk about impenetrable reality, even brute facts. The hard always seems real, just like the black mark on the white background. Even though it's black, it's the thing. Even though the solid is untransparent, unluminous, it seems to be more real than blue sky. This is a very partial point of view. Can you imagine a world that was solid without any space? The edges of the solid would be, of course, invisible. There would be no edges, because an edge is a point of interface between a solid and a space. So if you take away space, you take away solid. Right? Let's take away solid. Where's the space? After all, you say of space, it's a space between. If there are no limits, there's no space. Even if you imagine purely empty space, you've always got the sense of yourself looking at it, and that's the solid. Now, that's very awkward, because we are quite sure that space isn't there. We take no account of it, and therefore get puzzled when our mathematicians and physicists begin to talk about curved space, or properties of space, or expanding space. You can't, people say, the ordinary average person says, you can't talk like that, that's bunk. Space can't expand, because it's not there, it isn't anything, it can't do anything. Well, let's see if a solid can. Let's investigate a solid. You know what happens when you start going into nuclear physics. You find that in any given solid, however dense a piece of steel it may be, there's a great deal more space in it than there is any solid. The distances between molecules, the distances between atoms and subatomic particles are relatively vast. In something, there's a lot more nothing than there is any something. Because as you investigate and penetrate the solid, you find it to be increasingly spacious. Now, what happens when we investigate the spacious? How do you investigate space? Why, you go there. You bring in a solid. You map it. So space and solid are really like poles, they're limits. And it's the same with yourself and the other, the organism and the environment, the individual and the world. Go thoroughly into any one and you get the other. Ask, for example, the question, what do you mean when you love yourself? Love yourself thoroughly. I want you to be as completely selfish as possible. Tell me, what do you love? Wowee. See, well, I like candy. I like beautiful girls. I like beefsteak. I like wine. I like good bread. I like the sun on a lovely landscape. I like clear water. I like music. Come on, talk about yourself, will you, for a change? And I suddenly realize I can't. When I love myself, I think of all things other than myself that I love. It's very queer. But that's what's called the basic flip-floppability between the pairs of opposites. That's why the Chinese represent them with these two interlocked commas that suggests a kind of blip, 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 blip rhythm. So that when you get the full development of yang, you get the beginning of yin. And when you get the full development of yin, you get the beginning of yang. That is, the one implies the other. So they're always flipping, doing a flip. And doing a flip is the love that makes the world go round. You've got a double helix. So, the male and the female. That's the love position. The double helix. Spiral nebulae do this. So do creatures in sexual intercourse. The double helix. I'm chasing you, you're chasing me. I love you so much I could eat you. I realize myself, you see, only through other. So, in this way, then, we get another marvelous instance of the pairs of opposites. We've got the differences, and we see a unity between them. Then let's contrast the principle of difference with the principle of unity. Here we are again. We know what we mean by different, because we know what we mean by one. So difference implies unity, and unity implies difference. Now, what is it that lies beyond difference and unity? See, we found unity lying beyond differences, north and south. The difference is united in their poles of one. All right? Now let's take difference and unity. What lies between them? You could say your mind. As in the magnetic tape, what lies between the on signals, the one signals, and the zero signals? Why, of course, the tape. They're both on the tape. Only the tape, as such, doesn't register. It registers only in terms of yes or no. But you don't get a signal tape with yes, no tape, because it's irrelevant. Makes no difference. And yet if there weren't the tape there, you wouldn't get any signals at all. So is there something underlying yes and no, life and death, light and darkness? Well, that's what we call God. Only we can't say anything about it, because everything we say is a statement. And that implies an opposite. But as I pointed out in the beginning, this is so frustrating. Because we want to play a game with these opposites, you see. It's like we have opposites in chess, the black side and the white side. But we want to win. And we want to win. But then when we think of the other fellow, we realize that if I'm going to win, you're going to lose. I think that's rather hard, isn't it? Couldn't we arrange for a game in which everybody wins? But then nobody wins. Nothing happened. There was no game. So to try to play a no-lose game is impossible. We set ourselves an impossible task, and that makes us feel very frustrated. Always frustrated, because we're trying to do what can't be done. We want it good all the time. We want sunshine every day. Okay, a desert for you. Now that's not what you wanted, was it? Do you really want a world which is all positive? No, nobody really does. Only we think we do, and we think we ought to. But it still bothers us. Because after all, if I come to the conclusion that there's really, it doesn't make any difference, it's going to be black and white, life and death, good and evil, alternately, forever and ever and ever, I can't improve this world, I feel sort of sad, and I'm just going to sit around and vegetate. All the guts have gone out of me. And yet, I can't put up with that. I have an itch. Surely there must be some way of getting through. So what is it? Is there a great pleasure which lies beyond the ordinary contrast of pleasure and pain? What do the Hindus mean when they say that Brahman, the absolute reality, is Satchidananda? Sat, reality, chit, consciousness, ananda, bliss. What is ananda? What is metaphysical bliss? Joy beyond pleasure, pain, good, evil. has such a conception even any meaning? Well, in all the various accounts that are given to us of the mystical experience, they have an intense joyousness. The sudden realization that the dark and the light constitute a harmony. They are not discordant. That, as somebody once put it to me, this was a lady of 60 or so who was in an accident with an elevator, and she had her leg crushed, and they couldn't get a rescue crew to her for half an hour. But she said, during that time, I had the most extraordinary experience. I realized there wasn't one grain of dust in this whole universe that is out of place. And pretty weird. But from a strictly philosophical and logical point of view, it doesn't mean anything. If I say everything is good, no sort of a Christian Science attitude, it doesn't mean anything. It's no more from a logical point of view than saying everything is everything. That doesn't tell me anything. It's all good, it's all happy, it's all harmonious. And yet, if any one of you ever had an experience of cosmic consciousness, you know jolly well that those are no idle words. As you can see the positive and the negative, the yes and no, singing together, constituting each other in this fantastic dance in which the outward radiance flowing outward of the white light is at the same time the withdrawal of the black outline. And that withdrawal seems to be drawing aside a veil to show the white, the light. And if the veil didn't draw back, there would be no light. The veil did the drawing back for the light to shine. Or did the light shove the veil back? If it didn't shove, it hadn't got a veil to shove back, where would the contrast be? So you see the light and the dark playing with each other. So there is a concept in a game called good sportsmanship, which means that you can be a good loser, that you can play the part of lose with the same enthusiasm that you can play the part of win. And therefore what you look for is a good opponent, someone who will really give you a run. And so what you do is you let the opponent win every so often, and you have to try and keep yourself on top, as just a little edge on the other one, you see. Well, after a while, you see, your consciousness changes, and you find you're always a little on top when you average it out, and that gets boring. So you're going after a while to let the other person average out. But then you're going to count the spaces, do you see? For a year, you average out. Then you'll allow your partner to have 6 months being averaging out better. And you get a little more daring and give them 7 months. Then I'm going to catch up with you just at 11 months, and I'm going to come in again and I'm going to add another 12 months in which I'm the usual winner. See? But the more you think of that, the more you think, well, I'm kind of a cad to be like this. You're going to let the other person win. Because you can't maintain consciousness without the contrast, you see. That's why people go in for adventure. Why we take risks, why we do absolutely foolish things. Toss a coin and see what happens. Go skydiving. Let's go roaring around in racing cars. Let's even have wars. See what happens. Because some people are cautious and say, life is like a fire. And the thing to do is to keep it burning as long as possible. There are two kinds of pipe smokers. People who take enormous puffs and have vast clouds of smoke and the pipe burns out very quickly. And there are other people who very slowly take a puff and keep the pipe going for a long, long time. Some people like a quick, enormous flash. Others like a long, long, slow glow. Who's right? Who's left? You can take it either way. You may go off with a whimper, but we will go off with a bang. The morning glory blooms for an hour, and yet it differs not at heart from the giant pine that lives for 1,000 years. Fruit fly at the one end. Bzit lives a few hours. Tortoise at the other. Slow, solemn tortoise. Who lives for 500 years, but slowly. Maybe they both, from their own point of view, live the same time. Maybe the fruit fly thinks a few hours are very long, and the tortoise thinks 500 years are but 80 and all flesh is grass. From your own point of view, it's always the same, because it's your point of view. If you are a person born to riches, you will feel it's terrible to go down to poverty. But if you're born to poverty, that will be the usual state of affairs. You'll think it's extremely lucky if you rise to riches. But you see, I haven't really answered the question. Is there any way around this? Yeah, we can be a good sport. But it all comes out the same thing in the end. I mean, it balances out, and so what? What do you mean, so what? What's wrong with it doing that? Would you rather it was different? And if you really go into your thinking, you find you can't rather that it was different. When you see that you cannot have the positive without the negative, and if you want the positive, you'll have to take the negative. You say, well, it's making the best of it, you know, as if to say, well, the thing's kind of a lousy deal, but I'll take it. But I would ask you, what else would you have? Suggest me a better arrangement. And you'll suddenly find that if you do suggest what you think is a better arrangement, that won't be what you wanted. And you finally have to admit that you want it the way it is. Because the whole nature of wanting involves contrast. You want the good to be good, don't you? You want it to be real yummy. Okay. All right, so I'll give you nothing but chocolate eclairs with honey and a glass of champagne for breakfast every day, and for lunch and for dinner. Whew. You'll soon get sick of that. Or I'll give you a harem. You just keep it up day and night. And pretty soon you'll say, will someone take me to a bar? So by following this through the relentless logic of is you is or is you ain't, you come to the curious sensation that after all, if I really go into this problem of life, it is the way I want it to be. If I look at it superficially and in a sort of short run view, well, it isn't the way I want it. I want it changed right now, see? And I will, you see, life is like sleeping on a hard bed. You lie on your left side for a while and then you say, this, I can't stand this anymore, and turn on your right side. Same with politics. And you get tired of that, so you say, well, now I'll lie on my left. You get tired of that a little bit faster than you did before. You try the right again, it gets boring. So you try your back, and then that begins to get rough. Then you turn over and lie on your tummy. And then you switch to your back, and then to your tummy, and then you try your right side again, and then your left, you see. And so you proceed. But what else do you suggest? I would like it to be so that I was always comfortable. But you can see that if you were, you wouldn't know what comfortable is. So here's this puzzle. It's got two sides. Side one, I cannot beat the game of opposites. I cannot have more positive than negative. Side two, I wouldn't want it otherwise. Because I cannot imagine how to improve it. So involved in this is a sudden and curious initial deflation. I'm out of sorts when I feel that there's no impression I can make on it, is it? And yet I find who is this I that's trying to interfere and wants to be challenged and is put out of sorts? Well, when I look for it, I can't find it. I cannot find an I, myself, opposed to they or it. Because how could I have the one without the other? So, that feeling that I had of deflation, of frustration, was simply the realization there is no such thing as a separate I. Now, if you don't want to feel that truth, you will resist feeling it. But if you're open, this logic of the opposites of the game of black and white will lead you ineluctably to the conclusion that you have no separate self apart from what is called other. So there you are. You find that you are the vibration system, which is what's going on. You are the undulation, the pulsation called existence. That's you. And it's going wom 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 in ever so many different ways. Well, you see, is that all? What more did you expect? Well, I don't know, but I wanted just a little something more. You mean you want a surprise? I think we're back where we were a little while ago. But the surprise is in a way this. We are looking in this system for that little something more which will give it meaning. But we're looking for the wrong kind of meaning. The meaning of this, now you see it, now you don't. Is you is or is you ain't. This pulsation. The meaning of it is not apart from it, away from it, something different. The meaning of it is the dance, you see? That's why we get back to the point I made this morning. To get with this, you've got to swing. And swing means, I'll give it to you in a Zen story. A Zen student said to his teacher, "It's terribly hot. How do we escape the heat?" He said, why not go where it's neither hot nor cold? He said, where's that? The teacher said, in summer we sweat, in winter we shiver. So, it's the difference from in Shakespeare's Richard II, where Bolingbroke is about to be banished. And John of Gaunt, I think it is, says to him, to all places under the eye of heaven are to a wise man ports and happy havens. In other words, don't think the king has banished you. Think that you have banished the king. You weren't fired, you quit. And Bolingbroke replies, oh, who can hold a fire in his hand by thinking on the frosty Caucasus, or wallow naked in December's snow by thinking on fantastic summer's heat? Fell sorrow's tooth doth never rankle more than when it bites and lanceth not the sore. In other words, if during the winter I think of the summer, it's colder. And if during the summer I think of the winter or ice cream, it's hotter. So that's why the Zen master replies, in summer we sweat, in winter we shiver. When it's hot, eat curry. When it's cold, try ice water. Oh, swing with it. Roll with the punch. This is judo. Because the colder you make it, the hotter it'll get. Now we'll have an intermission.